Welcome to a first-of-its-kind, face-to-face D'Antonio Wingcast. That's right, Kevin Pelt decided to make the treacherous journey down from the woods of Seattle to the metropolis of Portland to watch the Blazers versus Sacramento Kings. Right now, we are a two-man dance party to, I believe, NSYNC. Don't ask. It's before the game, about an hour and a half. We're going to try this out. KP2, you're looking dapper in your Kings purple. How's it going?
I don't think this is purple. I'm the only one in the world who doesn't think this is purple. I think it's like magenta. I think it's more Blazers, actually. But whatever.
We just killed a woman. It was probably the greatest moment of my life. It was like an American Psycho. Okay, that never happened. You guys, this tape is going to be erased. We did not just kill a woman. I think she just tripped trying to stalk mini bar in one of the executive suites. Probably was trying to dance to this NSYNC song on one of the tables. We're off to a great start, aren't we, KP?
You know, I think it's good that we have decided to take this in person, because clearly it's already livened things up. Although I do kind of want to make, like, my voice a little bit muffled so it sounds like I'm on the phone like I normally am.
Yeah, why don't you run through some dead spots or pretend you're in a tunnel. Whoosh, whoosh. Like normal, and then I have to edit it for 5 hours. So look who's out early. Isn't that interesting? Tyreek Evans.
I was just behind Tyreek Evans on my way into the Rose Garden, getting our bags checked before the entrance, and I think all the Sacramento rookies have to carry pink and purple backpacks, so that was the one opportunity I'll have to laugh at Tyreek Evans.
And did he plow through the security line like he drives to the basket, just knock everyone out of his way and then get his tag first?
Amazingly, no. He was patient. You know, it's all about, you have different speeds on and off the court.
Is Tyreek Evans the best player in the NBA right now?
See, this is one of those situations where I normally fake the dead spot, so I don't even have to answer your ludicrous question.
See, I like Tyreek Evans a lot, and it's all just because of the Hoop Summit bias. Anyone who goes to the Hoop Summit, as long as I can pronounce their names, Tyreek Evans, John Wall, automatically on my good side. You get guys like Donatis, Motiekainis, or whatever that guy's name was, and I'm going to try to send them down the draft board. But Tyreek Evans was a phenom here 2 years ago. And now he's back for his first regular season game. He came here once during the preseason. He looked pretty solid. He's part of probably the best backcourt trio in the league with Sergio Rodriguez and Beno Udrich. And the Kings are really on all cylinders right now. This is going to be a good matchup. I'm pretty stoked.
You know, it's pretty good. I was talking about this earlier. And before the year, I had them pegged as the worst team in the league. So that's a prediction that's looking pretty bad right now. And the numbers certainly agree. But you know, their defense has been not good, but not abysmal like it was last year. You can win with not good. You can't win with abysmal. And then their offense has been phenomenal. You know, having Evans at the two and then being able to get minutes for Udrich, who has really bounced back from a terrible season last year that a lot of people thought was going to bury him entirely. And then they put a lot of shooters on the floor. Also out here working out early is my boy Spencer Hawes. Seattle native, UW grad, not grad, but UW Husky for a year.
It's awkward how he has a W painted on his chest and he's working out half naked. I don't know why he felt the need to do that. Is that something that you and him had coordinated? Are you going to rip your purple shirt off to reveal a purple W as well?
Well, this is just our excitement about Jake Locker being back for another year. You saw how excited Hawes was when Locker led the Huskies to the upset of USC in September.
You know, I was actually going back and talking about, you know, what were the best moments of 2009 in terms of the things that, you know, I went through on a daily basis. And obviously going to the dentist in February was up there. And a few other things were just really great. But I'd say that Washington upset of USC, when it was still an upset to beat USC, to see the genuine emotion from guys like Spencer Hawes, Nate Robinson, that was right up there. I mean, the playoffs, obviously, for the Blazers was probably the best sports moment of the year for someone in my position. Watching John Wall break out at the Nike Hoop Summit was pretty awesome, but Spencer Hawes is right there. He's the top three. I mean, that was a great moment. So anyway, let's talk about who gets the credit for these Kings' improved play. Are we going to give it all to Westfall, or are we going to give it to the improved personnel, or are the Maloofs paying their players under the table, or who gets the credit?
I don't think the Maloofs have any money to pay their players under the table right now.
They don't even have a table.
Yeah, the craps table got taken away. I give it to both sides. I think Westfall, you know, I was not the biggest fan of his after his stint coaching the Sonics. I don't think most people in Seattle are huge Paul Westfall believers. And I think that's probably one of the biggest understatements I've ever made. But you know, he's done a good job with them defensively. They've turned it over to one of their assistant coaches, and maybe we can edit in if I remember who, which assistant coach. Jim Ian.
Oh, I was going to say, it's probably Mario Ellie, right?
No. Jim Ian has helped them, and they've gotten better at the defensive end, as I said earlier. And then, you know, in terms of their personnel, Petrie has done a good job this year in the draft. He's gotten two competent rotation players right away. Tyreek Evans looks like he's going to be as good as almost anyone out of this draft so far. You know, you can make a case right so far that he's been the rookie of the year, even though Brandon Jennings has received more hype for his play. And then Omri Cosby, their second first-round pick, a guy who the Blazers had interest in and ultimately chose Victor Clavaire instead of. You know, he's shown the ability to contribute right away as a young guy in the NBA. He's a phenomenal shooter and a tough player, too.
For long-time Blazers edge readers, which means you've been reading for, what, 6 months or so, you may remember the draft prospect board that we put together before the NBA draft that ranked everyone that the Blazers had brought into Portland in terms of the likelihood that the Blazers would look to draft them. Cosby was right at the top of the board. You know, the one question with him when he came to working in his draft was his shooting stroke. I mean, his elbow was pretty much, you know, sticking out at a Sean Marion-like angle. And it really was hard to watch. Definitely drew some raised eyebrows from media as well as some of the coaches who were there. You know, a lot of the coaching staff, I think it's the first time they get to see some of these international guys. It's not like Nate McMillan and Monty Williams are really breaking down tons of EuroLeague tape before some of these guys come in. So they're really operating on a first impression basis as well, and I think some of them were a little bit thrown off by a shooting stroke. But obviously he's been pretty physical. He's clearly a mercenary, just like anyone you would expect to come out of the Israeli army. And he's a tough guy. I want him on my team. He's tougher than any of the Blazers.
Well, if there's any one guy that has shown the willingness to overlook an unorthodox shooting stroke, it's Jeff Petrie. Because, as you know, Kevin Martin has maybe the strangest stroke of any great shooter in NBA history. And, you know, he's been a great player for the Kings and now Cosby. So it's all about the results. And if they're going in, I don't care how it looks.
That's a very good point. You know, if they had television back when Jeff Petrie played, I wouldn't be surprised to see him have a really ugly stroke himself. All right, moving on. So that's the Kings. I mean, by the time we post this, the game's going to be over. And none of this is really going to matter, but we had a good 5 minutes about the Kings, right? So the Blazers are a hot mess right now, KP, too. Can we agree the Blazers are not going to win another game this year? 0-82 the rest of the way, even though there's not 82 more games to play.
What we maybe need on Blazers' edge is like a jumping off the name it a famous bridge in Portland. I don't know. What is it?
Burnside's probably the most famous bridge.
Jumping off Burnside meter, and right now I think it would be all the way over at the right on... Everybody's about to go over there like lemmings. You know, the panic level in Portland right now is at an all-time high, possibly.
It's pretty awesome, and I don't really get it. Do I sound panicked to you? Do I look like I'm about to flinch?
Somewhere in between. I think you've, you know, struck a measured level of concern about certain aspects of what the Blazers are doing, especially on the offensive end, without going overboard and, you know, calling for Nate McMillan's head. Out the pitchforks.
I'm not really sure how much we blame Nate for any of these things, right? So he's got, I think the main thing that you can really look at what Nate did is he came in with a plan, a very distinct plan at the beginning of the season, and his plan completely fell apart. And now 25 games in, he's picking up the pieces. But wasn't pretty much any plan going to fall apart given how many injuries they've had? I mean, if Greg Oden goes down, he's obviously a key aspect of any plan you're going to put together as a Blazers coach, right? Greg Oden goes down, and to a certain degree, I'm not trying to say that's your season necessarily, but to a certain degree, you're absolved of any responsibility for that, right?
Well, you know, to an extent, I disagree with you, because I think that they would still be searching for some answers even if Greg was healthy, even for that matter, if someone like Nicholas Batum was healthy. You know, even before there was always going to be the question of Andre Miller and how he was going to fit in. And we're a quarter of the way into the season. I don't think we have any better answer to that right now than we did when we started training camp.
And we can blame Nate for that.
We can't blame Nate for that, but I don't think it's all injury. I mean,
so we should blame Nate for that. I think we should blame Nate for that.
He's been searching, and you know, you can't find any continuity if you're changing the lineup regularly and things like that. But he's doing it in response to the fact that people aren't responding. I mean, you know, it's. I don't know how you evaluate all that.
See, here's the thing. I think. And this is a Wingcast exclusive. I haven't written this. I'm not sure how much power Nate has over some of these things. I'm wondering, you know, the decision to go to the three-guard lineup, the decision to increase Bayless's minutes now at this point, the decision to flop Miller over Blake potentially into the starting lineup, do those sound like Nate McMillan decisions to you, or do those sound like decisions that might be coming from someone like, oh, I don't know, Kevin Pritchard, who studies statistics, knows what the best lineups are, has a vested interest in Jared Bayless getting more playing time so that there's not behind-the-scenes squabbles? I mean, I think that Nate's a dominant personality here, but I'm not sure he's the only voice who has been behind some of these maneuvers.
You know, there's been those kind of whispers. It doesn't square necessarily with the Nate McMillan I know, because you know, part of what soured his relationship in Seattle was a feeling that he was getting too much influence from the front office, and it wasn't, you know, necessarily even in terms of dictating specific, you know, specific playing time and lineups and things like that, but just, you know, a general youth movement and a feeling that he wasn't, you know, on the same page as the front office in terms of the goals of the season up there, which he hasn't had an issue with here. You know, everyone was kind of clear that there was a rebuilding process, and last year was moving into winning time, and this year it was about winning even more games and getting deeper into playoffs and things like that. So I would be kind of surprised if that was the case, but you know, that talk has definitely been out there.
I'm not sure if I would have thought that would be the case at the beginning of the season, but as things go along, the more combinations Nate tries, the more smoke we hear from Jared Bayless, the less the Blazers are concerned about going deep into the playoffs, and the more they start setting their focus on just making the playoffs, the priorities shift, you know? And priorities shift away necessarily from trying to win every single night and put up, you know, then the same number of wins you put up last year with 54, and maybe not go into a rebuilding, but go into a more developmental stage when you've got guys like Jared Bayless and Dante Cunningham, who you've already committed to through next year, and you've got guys like Steve Blake and Juwan Howard, who you haven't committed to through next year. And you've got to wonder, you know, management would like to see a couple of those guys play, you would think. Obviously, both teams want to win. Who does Nate want to see play? I mean, you know, is Nate more likely to want to get Juwan Howard more minutes because it's less risky? Is he more likely to keep Steve Blake in that spot if he has his absolute druthers? I think he might be.
Yeah, but at some point, it's always going to come down to production. And the fact is, Howard hasn't produced as much as Dante Cunningham this season. You know, he wasn't playing well when he was in the rotation. Nate gave him that first shot and then went to Cunningham when it became clear that a change needed to be made. And even Blake has certainly not played nearly as well this year as he has the past couple of seasons. You know, along those lines, first hypothetical question number one. I mean, this isn't a hypothetical. Do you think the Blazers can still win 54 games?
Oh, hell no. No, not even close. Are you kidding? No, I mean, this team is so depleted, even if they're getting... Without Greg Oden, I just don't see it.
But Greg Oden wasn't that big part of the 54 wins a year ago. Why would he have to be... And he wasn't a part at all of the 41 wins 2 years
why.
Ago with a younger team.
Here's why. Because everybody's taking a step back. Steve Blake couldn't hit an igloo with a walrus. He's that cold. Brandon Roy, his shooting percentage is down, what, almost 5%? LaMarcus Aldridge is steady. Rudy Fernandez, down and out. Travis Outlaw, down and out. Jared Bayless has given you a little bit more than he did last year, but still has a long way to go. Dante Cunningham isn't giving you that much. Chris Billa is down from last year. They got a lot of negative indicators that would have been overlooked had Greg Oden been there. All right, we're back from a short break. Had to kill another woman. Anyway, so I just, during the break... The reason why we had to break is because KP went running and he was completely pissed because I dropped a knowledge bomb on his head, and that is Daryl Morey follows me on Twitter now. He doesn't even follow KP, and he did the foreword for KP's book. How do you like them apples?
Oh, I'm surprised. I'm stunned. I thought Daryl and I were tied on that. I think he's still upset that we didn't predict the Rockets to make the playoffs this season in pro basketball perspectives. He's holding that grudge like you normally hold grudges against me.
Well, that we have a lot in common, obviously. Me and Daryl can... We actually just, you know, direct message each other about the grudges that we hold against you. Maybe someday I'll copy them on them. But anyway, back to business here. So we were talking about Greg Oden and his loss and how the Blazers have struggled without him or may struggle without him. I don't think they can reach 54 wins because some other guys have taken steps back. This is actually something I learned from you in your book is, you know, you said that when guys have big career years, guys like Steve Blake, guys like Joel Prisbilla, the overwhelming statistical evidence is they're going to come back to earth the next year. I mean, it just doesn't happen that guys have multiple career years randomly as they get to that stage of their career, correct?
Hollinger and I, you know, both of our statistical systems predicted drops for Blake and Prisbilla, and I, you know, a lot of Blazers fans were like, that's crazy, but you're starting to see how that kind of plays out. But I think they've played worse even than we projected so far. I mean, not without having looked at the numbers specifically, you know, just off the top of my head, I think Blake is shooting much worse than even we projected for him. So I still think there's room for improvement for him. And, you know, the any drop off for Brandon Roy that was projected was, you know, gradual at the most. So I think that there's still room for him to play better than he has. And I think that's where, again, you get back to where Andre Miller has impacted a lot of things.
Well, let's just be real clear. If any computer had predicted what Blake would shoot this season accurately, that computer would have exploded. I mean, the computer wouldn't be here anymore. I mean, did you see the stat that we put up yesterday about short shot clocks? Steve Blake shooting 13% on a short shot clock. Who do they try to move the ball to in the corner late in the shot clock for a bailout three? Steve Blake. Who consistently gives them zeros? Steve Blake. I mean, he's fallen off pretty hard. And it's not all his fault. I mean, Brandon deserves a bulk of the responsibility for the team's struggles. I will consistently maintain that because he's your franchise player. He's your best player. He's the guy who's not as efficient or effective on offense as he was last year, period. I mean, if you want to blame it on Andre Miller, fine. There's a lot of possessions where they're not on the floor together and Brandon's still not as effective and efficient as he was last year. So is that a good sign maybe for the Blazers that he could really turn it up as the season goes on? Absolutely. You've got to keep him motivated, and Brandon doesn't seem like the most motivated player right now. And I don't know how you fix that.
Well, yeah, let's talk about the Brandon Roy backlash because it's on in full swing right now. And, you know, we've seen it several times on Blazers Edge. You know, I think it's interesting because there's a strong sense that part of the issue is that Brandon is inflexible and is not adjusting to everybody else out there. But, you know, from my perspective, I think that that's not what you ask superstar players to do. I mean, you do to an extent, but what you do is you build around your superstar players' strengths and weaknesses, and I don't think that's what the Blazers have done right now. So I don't think it's I don't think it's totally fair to criticize him. You know, would Dwayne Wade be really responding well if the Heat had added someone like Andre Miller? I mean, not, you know, it's not specific to Andre Miller. It's not anything personal with him. Just that type of player, someone who needs the ball in his hand, A, and B, opponents are double-teaming off him like he's not even there. There could be a dummy standing over there in the three-point line, and they would be just as frightened of that shooting three as they are of Andre Miller right now, which is causing a lot of problems. But teams are defending Brandon Roy different than they are last year, and I think they learned something from the playoff series. So you come back to that's what the front office saw is we need something else to go to when Brandon is getting collapsed on like this, and so far that hasn't worked, and I I'm not sure I know why, and I'm not sure I know what that would be.
And that's the big problem right now is they don't have any other reliable scoring options, and maybe that's a function of Travis Alau being out. Maybe that's a function of Brandon just not playing with the guys who can really put the ball in the basket as much as he should have been. Brandon gets virtually no minutes with Bayless. Bayless can score. We already talked about how he doesn't get as many minutes as he probably should with Andre. Andre can score. When Brandon plays with LaMarcus in the second half, Brandon's not really looking for LaMarcus. Brandon's looking for Brandon. And so if Brandon's not performing, you've got a big problem. And I think that's the big question for the rest of December going forward into January is, does Brandon Roy start to feel the internal pressure of playing like an all-star and carrying his team to victories like all-star, and does he rise to that pressure? That's the big question. And I don't have an answer for you one way or the other. I just think that that's the pivotal question. With nine guys on the court, the team's going to go as far as Brandon takes it, period. And we'll see how it shakes out. And I think Nate understands that to a certain degree. I think he tries, and his solution to this point has been give Brandon as much room as possible and just expect Brandon to deliver, even if the defenses are changing, even if everybody else is adjusting to the fact that Brandon, you know, knowing what Brandon can do. And it's adjustment time for Nate. It's time for him to figure something else out. Is it moving Brandon off the ball? We've talked about that. Is it picking up the pace a little bit so that they're not taking so many shots so late in the shot clock? Brandon's not bailing the team out so late in shot clocks. That's probably a good idea. Is it working LaMarcus more seamlessly into the offense rather than the isolations? That's probably would help. But I don't know. What else do you see the team could do on offense to really get things going with its current personnel? So not with any trades, with its current personnel.
You know, it's tough to say. And the one thing I think has been a disappointment, other than maybe the Cleveland game, I don't know, the road trip has already started to run together for me. You didn't see Aldridge take the kind of step forward that I think we expected to see after
the Milwaukee
great
game.
It was Milwaukee, yeah, okay, yeah. You're right. That we expected to see without Greg Oden because of the fact that he was going to be getting so many more post touches and especially early in games, whereas his role had changed probably the most dramatically of anyone because of what Oden had done in terms of his evolution this season. So, you know, I think that figuring out a way to get him going may be even more important than getting Roy going because of the fact that you need that second guy, as we've talked about. But, you know, I want to, and I don't... You talked about running, and I think Nate has encouraged a team. I think there's still a reluctance for some reason to run. I think Brandon may be a part of that.
I think Brandon's a part of the problem with not running, but I think also, I mean, Blake just can't run, period. I mean, he's not built for it. You know, some guys are built for it, some guys aren't. Blake's not built for it. And then, you know, Bayless, maybe he can help pick up the pace, but I'm not sure they want to run necessarily or just, you know, get into their sets quicker and look to shoot quicker. You know what I mean? I'm not necessarily saying that it needs to be running, but I think they can pick it up from where they're at. I mean, they're like a stalled car at this point.
Yeah, you know, during the 2004-05 season with the Sonics, one of the mentalities they had, and I go back to that season a lot because it was the one time I ever covered a winning team, so besides being down here in Portland, the mentality was get it early or get it late. So he talked about running and trying to push the ball out, and that team had a real reputation as being a running team because partially because they were so much better on offense than defense. And you have Luke Ridenour, who's a quick point guard, but they also were very comfortable playing deep into the shot clock, and I think that was same was true of last year's Portland team also. But I don't know why that's changed this year. You know, that kind of baffles me. And I don't know if it's maybe because of the fact that there's not the same established pecking order on offense that there was last year, you know, where guys know who to look to at late in the shot clock.
Well, I think part of it is Brandon Roy's effectiveness. I mean, I think Hollinger was the one who presented the idea that, you know, even I think it was this morning or last night, where that last year's season for B-Roy could have been an outlier. In other words, he shot better than we can expect him to shoot. And that definitely happened late on shot clocks a lot last year. I mean, Brandon Roy was very effective shooting the ball on very short shot clocks. Deep into possessions, he was totally comfortable, embraced the idea, said he loved the pressure. I mean, that was all about what Brandon was, that's all Brandon was about last season. This year, whether guys are throwing late doubles at him, that maybe that's throwing him off, or he doesn't have the faith to pass out of those situations because the guys aren't hitting shots, so he's forcing more up. Guys are giving him the flaming bag passes, so he's got to shoot shots that he wouldn't normally, and he's forcing them more. I mean, all of that starts to get into your head and take a toll over the course of 25 games. I mean, I don't think it's any accident he's down 7% shooting in those situations, you know? I mean, it's a failure to get easier shots early, and then it's an over-reliance on Brandon late. And it's basically, in his eyes, a lack of trust in his teammates to be there, you know, at quote-unquote crunch time, even if it's not late in the game, but it's late in the shot clock.
Well, let's talk about something else Hollinger brought up, and that's that a lot of the change in the offense this year really can be traced to one factor, which is offensive rebounding. Why isn't this team hitting the glass the way it used to? I mean, you can point to the absence of Greg Oden the last couple weeks, and that's an obvious reason because Greg Oden is as good as anyone in the league on the offensive glass. But he was playing more minutes than last year early in the season, and yet this team still wasn't rebounding the way it once was. Any explanation for that?
Well, it's probably trading Sergio Rodriguez. No, you know, Nicholas Batum, I mean, he's an active guy. Sometimes you get offensive rebounds through pure hustle. I'm not sure what his actual offensive rebound numbers were, but, you know, his presence, I'm not sure if I have a good explanation for that. I mean, the team's not playing as hard as it did last year. I think everyone would agree with that. I mean, the effort's just not there, and that gets reflected in things like offensive rebounds, is the fact that Brandon and LaMarcus both got themselves contracts, and they're setting a tempo or a tone that's different on a night-in-night-out basis than they did last year. I think it's fair to say that. I mean, these guys, you know, I wrote about this earlier, is Brandon does not take losses nearly as hard as he did last year, you know? He just is not as personal to him. It, for whatever reason, it matters differently. And I think there's a tendency in contract years or negotiation years to kill yourself, to really go after it, because you realize the long-term implications of success in the short term are life-changing and $5, $10 million, you know, difference at some point. So that would be my explanation. Do you have any explanation, or are you just posing rhetorical questions?
I'm mostly posing rhetorical questions, and I haven't looked at the numbers. I think Aldridge probably is not rebounding as much. He's probably spending more time on the perimeter this year, which is a factor. And the floor isn't spaced as well. I think, you know, floor spacing. Go back to the Kings. Their floor is spaced really well. That's a lot of why they succeed, and it's because they have shooters. And then floor spacing also creates opportunities on the glass because of the fact that, you know, they're closing out hard, things like that. They're not thinking about the inside. But what I guess what this is all kind of leading me is here's my rhetorical question, which is, if let's say that the Blazers had no cap space this summer, they did not sign Andre Miller, they brought back essentially the same core except they traded Sergio Rodriguez, Jared Bayless stepped into the lineup, Martell Webster got healthy, you know, the couple draft picks, very minor changes. Is this team struggling right now?
Well, I think if they have all the same injuries, I think they're still going to be struggling. I think it's going to be, you know, a cleaner setup. In other words, you're probably getting more from certain guys like Bayless and Cunningham. You know, you're probably relying on them to play more minutes earlier in the season, so they probably have a little bit more definition. I think Brandon's probably a little bit more comfortable. He might play a little better. So I think they might be better, but at the end of the day, you can't lose multiple starters and expect to continue on, especially when you're replacing them with guys like Martell Webster, who is completely inconsistent. You don't know what you're going to get from them. You can't have guys like that playing big minutes and not struggle. At least the Martell Webster we've seen recently. I mean, if that's your best three, that's who's supposed to be guarding LeBron James or Kobe Bryant or whatever, you're going to struggle against the good teams. You're just not going to be as good as you were last year. There was an element of consistency they had last year. You knew what you were going to get almost every game. It wasn't always pretty. You know, if they shot hot, they would probably win. If they weren't hitting, they'd probably lose. But for the most part, you knew the effort was going to be there on defense. They went balls to the wall. Everybody tried. Not getting that this year at all.
So how do you do that? I mean, is that something where this team needs a major overhaul, or is it minor tweaks?
Well, that's the question. And I think, it comes down to Brandon. You know, if Brandon steps up and he pulls it together and he decides he really wants to commit himself, everyone else will follow suit. If he doesn't, then you got to start wondering, how does the coaching staff get through to him? How does the management get through to him? How do you convince a player who's set for life, basically, that in a season where he's lost all of his teammates, that he should still be gunning and he shouldn't be saving himself, say, for the Olympics or the World Championships or next season when it's actually going to matter more? And I'm no psychology expert. I'm not really a master motivator. I can't even get you to call in the right times on podcasts. Okay? So how am I going to be able to convince Brandon Roy to play hard? I mean, all I can do is look in his eyes after the game with puppy dog eyes and say, you know, what's your role? You know, are you playing as well as you would hope that you're playing, and see what he says, and, you know, apply some pressure online. And that's pretty much all I can do here. I can't work magic. And I think that what you're getting from me right now is a little bit of helplessness. It's like, there's not really solutions, right? And I think Nate McMillan feels the same way. I think he's right now feeling a little bit helpless, feeling like he's got to basically pull out every stop because his guys aren't gutting out games like they used to, and his teams have always been known for that, and it's not happening now. And that's a helpless feeling if you're a coach. If you're a motivating coach, you're always getting 110% from your guys, and then you stop doing that for a while, then you got to start wondering, can I do it again, you know?
Do you think there's an element in there of Nate's voice wearing on the guys? You know, he's not a screamer like a Scott Skiles, but if you want to talk about guys who succeed more on maybe motivation than X's and O's or putting things on the players in the right spot, which, you know, I'm not sure is completely fair, because I think Nate succeeded more with the latter in Seattle, really, than in terms of pure motivation. But, I mean, is there a shelf life to that kind of approach?
I think there's a shelf life to any coaching approach, you know, unless you're freaking John Wooden and, you know, you're a Buddha when it comes to coaching and motivating people, and you've got no shelf life because you're 162 years old and you're still alive, which I think people should probably investigate how John Wooden is still alive. And he's still cranking out books, too. He's got like 3 books out for the Christmas holidays, you know?
And they're all outselling my book.
Yeah. And I endorse all of them and not Kevin's book. And Daryl Morey's doing the forward for all 3 of them. And he's following John Wooden on Twitter. But anyway, there's a shelf life to any approach. But the thing is, Nate's guys seem to like Nate. You know, that's the impression that I get. I don't get this idea that they're tuning him out. Maybe to a certain degree with like the 3-guard lineup, there was probably some resistance from some of the key players in terms of like, what are we doing here? Why are we taking this approach? It's not what we're going to do in the playoffs. I totally understand that. But when your coach blows out his Achilles trying to play with you, I think the guys, honestly, if I was a player, I'd be like, word, that's awesome. I would love that. I mean, it wasn't the smartest thing in hindsight, and Dave probably wishes he didn't do it. But if you're one of his players, don't you look at that and say, this coach is riding with us. He's not giving up on us. I'm not going to give up on him.
He's giving us his 100%, 110%. The ironic thing about that is if you look at it by the numbers, by far the most successful lineup all year has been the three-guard lineup. And I don't know if at some point you just have to say, I know that the numbers make no sense, but they are what they are, and we got to throw this out again.
I mean, see, that's the thing is, though, Nate's got himself in the corner because you know he's made promises to Brandon. You know, he's made concessions to his star, and that's kind of what I was trying to get at earlier with how much power and control does Nate have over the situation. If you're Nate, you realize the three-guard lineup was the best basketball you played all year. Even if it was against bad teams, you know that, even regardless of the numbers. But you also have Brandon in your office saying, Coach, I don't want to have to guard threes. I want to guard twos. And you've got Martell Webster sitting there, probably picking his boogers and, you know, wearing his Burger King hat that he wears during the promos at the Rose Garden. God knows what he's doing, but I'm just kidding, guys. Come on. Don't take it too personally. But, you know, Nate's got pressure from both sides, you know? He's got pressures from his players. They don't want to play that way. And even if it works, sometimes players don't necessarily want to do what works the best. And that's why, to me, he made concessions to the players to get out of that lineup. Now what's he going to do? Go back to them again and try to pitch it to them again? It was already a hard sell the first time. Can he go back to do it again?
So it's safe to say that we don't envy Nate McMillan whatsoever in trying to figure out what's going wrong here, that there are no easy answers, and if you're peddling easy answers, probably you're blowing smoke.
Absolutely. No, I don't think there's any question about that. I don't envy Nate McMillan at all. I mean, especially because he has to ride a wheelie cart around. But I don't envy him because there's no easy solution here. You've got 9 guys. A couple of them can't play. Great. You know, what are you going to do? All right, well, the hot rumor recently has been, first, it was Bayless being unhappy, either demanding a trade or not demanding a trade. KP came out and denied it. Bayless came out and denied it to me yesterday at practice, said his agent hasn't asked for it, and he was pretty straightforward about that. For now, I'll take him at his word, although it's clear he's very uncomfortable. He's not happy. He's frustrated. He wants more minutes. He's earned more minutes. He knows it. Pretty much everybody knows it. It's a question whether Nate knows it or not. I think Nate's finally coming around. And with him being on the rookie contract, it's really hard to see them trading Jared Bayless, given how much Kevin Pritchard likes Bayless. So the question is, okay, well, do you trade Andre Miller, which seems to be your preferred strategy, or do you trade Steve Blake? And I think the assumption was, all through the fall, was that the Blazers had maybe traded for traded for Miller with the idea of flipping him. In other words, trading him back out after they signed him this summer. But now, recently today, Chad Ford of ESPN.com wrote a column saying that when GMs were contacting Pritchard about Miller within the last 48 hours, the statement they've received from Pritchard is that Miller's not available, but Blake is. And we've talked in the past about how Blake might make some sense to be an odd man out, given his expiring contract, given that he's kind of already peaked. So I guess now that we've seen them for 25 games, who would you rather see, if, let's say you're Nate McMillan, you're the coach of the Blazers, who would you rather see go out, Blake or Miller, and why? And what would you want to get back?
I mean, it's tough to answer because of the fact that, you know, obviously Miller is the better player and Blake has struggled, as we've talked about all through this podcast, but Blake remains the better fit. And, you know, it's really a case of trying to fit two square pegs into round holes to some extent. Blake because of his defense, and Miller because of, you know, the way he plays on the offensive end. So, you know, to some extent, it may just come down to who gets more value. And Miller, you know, presumably has more value overall, but, you know, the expiring contract is a big deal. You know, one team I can see making a lot of sense for Blake is Miami, which is a team which is looking for help at the point guard position behind or maybe even in front of Mario Chalmers. They need guys like Blake, who, like the Blazers do, who can shoot and play off the ball and play off their star guard, Dwayne Wade. And, you know, they've got other expiring contracts that they might be willing to flip just to mix up their personnel. Udonis Haslem, perhaps, he's a name that I think has been connected in the past. You know, he's someone who could come in here and solidify your backup front court position. If you're concerned about having a rookie Dante Cunningham even in there, even though they have very kind of similar skill sets and scouting. So that's something you might see.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the question is, okay, so let's say you are really going to trade one of these point guards out. What are you trying to get back at this point? Well, are you comfortable with going Blake and either Bayless or Miller, or sorry, Bayless and either Blake or Miller as only your two point guards? I mean, is that enough point guards going forward? Or are you going to have Patty Mills try to play that third string point guard when he's back healthy? Or do you trade a point guard out to try to get a point guard back? In that case, aren't you just, you know, swapping your own crap for somebody else's crap? I mean, are you able to get fair value back if you're looking at point guard? Or do you look front court like you're talking about? Or do you look, you know, athletic wing? Al Harrington's name got mentioned. I don't think that Al Harrington is really a culture fit here in Portland. Do you go that direction? I mean, if you're Kevin Pritchard, do you just want picks? Do you want, I mean, are you just looking to get healthy bodies? I mean, what do you really need at this point? And what's going to motivate you to trade one of these guys who you know what they could do and you know that they're relatively good people? They're not cancers by any stretch of the imagination. What motivates you to move? I'm not sure what that would be.
Well, the motivation is that you feel like you got to mix things up because the team is struggling. I think that's a lot of it.
No, but I mean, what are you going to get back to make that decision final? I mean, you want to mix things up, right? But you're not just going to trade someone away for nothing. I mean, you want to get something back. And he's looking. I mean, I think that Pritchard cares what people say about his deals. I don't think Pritchard is trying to give players away like he gave away Sergio again. I think he doesn't want to get the label of the guy who hangs onto his assets too long and then gets crap back. You know what I mean?
Well, let me throw out a name there that we're all very familiar with. The Blazers edge readers are probably tired of hearing about, but Kirk Heinrich has struggled almost as much as Stevie Blake and some of the Blazers guys to start this season. You know, he's banged up. Could he be out of Chicago's future? And is he someone you might want to look at and be willing to take on that contract just because on paper he's a very good fit alongside Brandon?
So tricky to know with Heinrich. I mean, I'm not sure he's the guy that makes you. If he wasn't the guy the last 2 years, why is he the guy now? Just because you're struggling with through injuries,
because you've tried other things and they haven't really panned out.
I mean, at the end of the day, they're still 14-11, right? Do you think they can let themselves get to below 500 before they make a move? I mean, I think if you're Pritchard, you're trying to buy time now, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair, and especially because of the fact that you know you've got some guys back on the way, coming back. So, you know, your picture looks a little more clear if you know if, say, Jeff Pendergraft can maybe help give you 10 minutes a night.
So, I think in conclusion, we've decided that we're not sure if we're going to trade any of these point guards. Personally, I'm fine with Blake going out and just trying the Andre Miller thing. You know what? If it doesn't work and you screwed up that signing last year, so be it. I think you kind of have to roll the dice with him. You know, after this summer, I think you can just say, fine, Bayless, it's your team for next year, and you can go that direction with everybody back healthy and hope that works out for you, or you can, you know, explore other possibilities at that point. I think Blake would be, in my opinion, the best one to trade out with the expiring contract and maybe in combination with somebody else. Maybe you can get somebody back. I would be trying to target a versatile wing at this point, ideally one with no longer than a 2-year contract. I have to look out, you know, at maybe storytellers' contracts or somebody else about who might fit that bill. I don't think you have to get a ton back here. I think you just need a body. One solid body, maybe even a pick, you know?
Well, I'm going to preach patience. I think you got to give this a couple more weeks to see how things shake out before you do anything. I wouldn't do anything before the turn of the new year.
I hear you on that. I think that's a fine approach. I think you got to let it go below 500 before you make a trade, at the very least. And they could be there by January, certainly, but who knows? They may respond. Let's hope they do tonight. All right, we're done, KP2. We tried our first live podcast. It was probably a disaster. How'd it feel?
You know, it was good up until the point where you started ruining my career.
Well, I'm going to go talk to Daryl now on the phone, so, you know, you can go probably mingle with some of the riffraff down here. Have a good one.
All right, enjoy the game.
I'll be sitting right next to you. I became more curious. Fuck being up north, delirious, more serious. So killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment, sports, drugs, entertainment.